Okay, a pleasure to welcome back from Israel. I've often introduced, you know, Rabbi Lakshin when he lived in Toronto, and it's, I guess, an extra special pleasure to welcome him back to Toronto, living in Yerushalayim for the last year. And I want to start off by wishing him a mazel tov. He became a grandfather again on Friday. I feel a little bit guilty for having him here, and he missed the baby naming of his grandfather.
For having said yes.
I apologize. Next time, you know, you will plan it less than 9 months in advance. Okay, and we all know Rabbi Lakshin, professor at York University for many years, a distinguished scholar, expert on the Rashbam, and really a friend of Torah in Motion for many, many years, and it's a pleasure to have you. Just one word, if anybody's interested in hearing him this evening, he'll be speaking on Rabbi Krause's, Beit Din for Agunot. At the Freudenstein home, if you're interested, I'll tell you where they live exactly, 134 Glen Park, I guess I can say. Now, that's going to be at 8 o'clock this evening on Rabbi Krause's, Beit Din. Bavakasha, that's Dr. Lakshin.
Yes. Incidentally, about this evening, I will speak more widely. I will say wonderful things about Rabbi Krause's international Beit Din, but I will speak more widely on the issue of Mesorah Avot Get, about women who have been denied a religious divorce. But the topic this morning, Tanakh this morning, and the topic that I want to talk about today is the tension that all of us feel between what we are told is the proper Jewish interpretation of the Bible, the thing that we have to do as religious Jews, and what we see when we read the Bible. I think all of us kind of discover this tension when we're little children, and we find out that you're not supposed to eat meat with milk, and you ask why, and they say, because it says, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, because you're not allowed to boil a kid in its mother's milk. And we all sit there scratching our head and saying, what is the connection between those words, between what it says in the Bible, and what it is that we are supposed to do? Now, that might not even be the hardest kind of example, because both of those things could be true at the same time, that you're not supposed to boil a kid in its mother's milk, and you also shouldn't eat a cheeseburger. It doesn't say that you shouldn't eat a cheeseburger directly, but these things are compatible with each other. But sometimes it's even worse. When you're reading a verse and you see that it says that a Jewish slave is supposed to go free after 6 years, but if he decides to stay and goes through a certain ceremony, it says va'avado le'olam, then he'll be his servant forever. And then you read the halacha, and the halacha says, well, forever doesn't mean forever. Forever means just until the Jubilee year. And you say, well, I always thought that I knew what the word forever means. And so which one is it? What do you do with this kind of tension between what it seems to us through our standard reading abilities that a biblical verse actually means, and what it is that Jewish tradition has understood the verse as meaning? So what I want to do today, incidentally, feel free to interrupt me with comments, questions, challenges at any point in this presentation. What I want to do in a whirlwind kind of way is go through three different theories about how to deal with this tension that exists between what the Bible says and what Jewish law is telling us to do, and compare them, and then maybe we'll have time, we'll see if we have time, for a little bit of a discussion of which one of these kinds of theories appeals to you most. After the panel discussion last night, a couple people came up to me who learned Gemara on a regular basis and said, you know, a problem that we have when we read Gemara is the Gemara says something and then it says she'ne'emar, because it says in the biblical verse, and then we open up the Bible and we look at the biblical verse and, there's nothing there that seems to be supporting our understanding of what the Gemara is saying. And they said to me, you know, how do you deal with that? And I said, well, that's, in essence, one of the things I'm trying to address here today. So The only way to address this, instead of just talking about it in theory, is talking is looking at some real verses in the Torah and real interpretations of those verses, and we'll extrapolate from that and try to pick up a method. Okay, so we start. People have handouts? Good. Great. Somebody want to read? Sophia, you want to read the pasuk, the top of the page? Go ahead. Pardon me? Whichever one you prefer. Thank you very much. The context of this, it says, you know, what you do in an inheritance. If somebody dies, who the first heir is, who the second heir is, if somebody has sons, if they don't have sons. If they don't have sons and they don't have daughters, then the inheritance goes to the brothers. If they don't have sons or daughters and they don't have brothers, but they have uncles, then the inheritance goes to the uncle. It's just kind of listing who the nearest kin is. And then in the last verse it says, "Imein achim la'aviv." If the father didn't have any brothers, in other words, there are no uncles in the family, then, you know, it just says, on the pshat level, it says, assign his property to his nearest relative, so there are still relatives that, even though the closest relatives don't exist, everybody has relatives, and so you can find the closest relative. Okay, so we think we know what the verse means, and then we open up the Gemara. David, you want to read the Gemara here? See, the problem when you sit in the front row, you get picked on. So, yeah.
That's why
you
should always sit in the back.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Okay. So a man inherits his wife's estate. How do we know? So there's nothing in the Torah about the question of spouses inheriting from each other. There's no mention of it at all. But the Gemara says that a man does inherit his wife's estate if she predeceases him. And I'm sorry, you know, I didn't write these laws, but the laws are a man inherits his wife's estate. A wife does not inherit her husband's estate. At some point, the ketubah was expanded to often cause that the woman inherited the entire estate. When they started writing at one point in history, when they started writing Matayim Zekukim Kesef Tsaruf, that was an awful lot of money when they started, thank you, when they started writing that in the Ketubah. So it often happened, once medieval times came along, it often happened that the woman did inherit the entire estate because of the amount that was written in the Ketubah. But the original halacha in the Gemara is the man inherits his wife's estate if she predeceases him, and the woman does not inherit the husband's estate. And how do we know this? So the Gemara says, because it is written, V'yarash ota. Hu yoresh ota, ve'ein hi yoreshet oto. What has the Gemara done with this phrase, v'yarash ota?
They've substituted a new referent for the pronoun.
Excellent. Excellent syntactical analysis. Yes, ota, the referent, the antecedent for ota, was actually the nachala. He will inherit it. The inheritance, which is a feminine, all nouns in Hebrew are either masculine or feminine. The noun for inheritance is feminine, and so he will inherit it, ota. And then they turn it into he will inherit her. And how do we know that the her is a wife? Because she'ero must mean wife. Okay, we'll get back to this claim that she'ero means wife. Okay, so that's what the Gemara says. And you can see, for those of you who can tell the difference here, that text is in Hebrew, meaning that it's an old Tannaitic from the time of the Mishnah text. And then the rabbis, the last line of the Talmudic text is written in Aramaic. It's later. Somebody just says, but that's not what the verses say. Vaha cry lav hachiktivi. That's a, they're reading this verse in a way that is not consonant with what is actually in the verse. Okay, so how are we going to deal with the tension that exists between the what the verse says and what the Gemara learns from the text? Okay, so now we are ready to see approach number one of how to deal with the conflict between what the rabbis say we learn from the Bible and what we think the Bible says. So here's Rashi at the bottom of the page here. The words, I'll just read it in English. The words v'yarash ota are superfluous. And Rashi's right about that. If you look back at the verse itself, if you left out those two words, v'yarash ota, nothing would be missing. If you just said, v'imein achim la'aviv u'ntatem ad'nachlato l'sheiro akarov elav b'mishpachto, you've said everything. If his father has no brothers, you shall assign his property to his nearest relative in his own clan. And that, what do we need those two words? And he shall inherit it. They serve no purpose. No additional information is added there. They serve as a basis for the drasha that a man inherits from the drasha, the midrash, that a man inherits from his she'er, and she'er means wife. Even though she'er in scripture does not mean wife, you know, Rashi knows that she'er is not a Hebrew word for wife. In fact, she'er probably has something more to do with a blood relative. In the standard context where the word she'er appears, and you know, while the relationship between spouses we see as being the strongest kind of relationship, it is not a blood relationship. We are not generally blood relatives of our spouses, and so she'er is a reference to blood relations and not to spousal relations. So even though she'er in scripture does not mean wife, once the verse has superfluous words in it, we offer such a drasha. So this is Rashi's theory of why there is a tension between what we derive from the Bible and what is actually written in the Bible. And I would say that this is probably the most common theory about how it works and why there is a tension between what the Bible says and what halakha derives from it. The theory goes like this. We will read the Bible using standard tools of reading until we bump into superfluous words. Once we bump into superfluous words, then a light goes off. Aha! We now know that using standard reading techniques, we won't succeed in understanding why those words are there. At that point, we have to use non-standard reading techniques in order to make some sense out of those superfluous words. And using that non-standard reading technique, so what else could we do with Vayarash Ota? We could say Vayarash Ota means her instead of it, meaning wife instead of inheritance. Okay, so that's Rashi's approach, which I would say is probably the most common approach in Jewish history over the years for how to deal with this. Any questions or comments before I go on? Yes, Anna, please.
I'm wondering, I mean, I unfortunately haven't seen the rest of this particular sugya. Is that addressed? Is that underlying? Can we assume that's underlying? Is that too historically thinking of me?
So, you know, I think that this Midrash Halacha is probably Eretz Yisraeli, because it's written in Hebrew. But your point is right, that the tribal structure has disappeared. That there is a certain argument for saying that that the wife does not inherit from the husband because it wrecks up the tribal situation of the land. So if I'm from the tribe of Dan and I'm living in the middle of the area of Dan, and my wife is from the tribe of Naphtali, and I predecease my wife, and that she inherits it, then suddenly we've got this little patch of Naphtali in the middle of Dan. That might have been the original. I agree with you entirely. That might have been the original thinking of it, but it doesn't make much sense to see that as being from the time of the Midrash Halacha, because you're right, there wasn't a... In other words, it's thinkable that there could have been a tradition like that in biblical times when there was a tribal structure. Yes, Sophia. It isn't so much rejected, it's refined a little later on. Yes, saying that they should marry within the same tribe. But this is actually from the beginning of the Tzlofchad story. It's not, you're right, there's a second part of this Tzlofchad story, but that part of it they don't see as changing. Okay, yes, please. Right.
If I read this deals everything with describing motivation, but nothing about the reason behind it.
Right. Oh, yes. That's true. And any student of the Talmud knows that that's a certain frustration of the study of Talmud, where that very often the Talmud does not talk about motivation. I have a chavruta with whom I study who's really into economic analysis of things, and he's always turning to me and saying, what could be the theory behind this? What was their economic understanding of society, and why was this a good thing for society to have the rule this way? And I, as the yeshiva boy trained student of Talmud, I say, I don't know anything about it. I just know what they say, that there's a pasuk here and there's a pasuk there. You put them together. And he's trying to, so yes. So there is that certain frustration that we have no attempt to come up with what the motivation is behind it. Okay, so now we move on to approach number two. The approach number two is the approach of Abraham Ibn Ezra. So we have a long comment here on page two where Ibn Ezra is essentially making fun of the Talmudic passage that we just looked at. And he says, Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on some of the books of the Torah, and on some of them he actually started to write a third. The last version of his commentary on the Torah is just called Shita Acheret, like another way of reading the Torah. And we've just found the introduction and scraps of the Breishit commentary, and we haven't found the whole thing, but we do have the introduction, and this is the mature Ibn Ezra's thought on the subject. Abraham Ibn Ezra, the Jewish Marco Polo, writing in the 12th century, started his life in Spain, went east as far as Israel, claims to have gotten as far as India. I have no reason to think that Ibn Ezra was a liar, so let's say he got to India, then traveled back to the West, and then wrote most of his books in Italy, France, and the last thing, the Shita Acheret, he wrote in England just before he died in the 1160s, 1170s. I'll read it in English, and those of you who can follow the Hebrew can follow in the Hebrew. Maybe the first line, because it's so shocking, I'll just read it in the Hebrew. Im matzanu b'divrei ha-kabbalah davar she'yachish ha-katuv. Whenever we find in tradition a teaching that contradicts scripture, nevakesh ezo mehem hi emet levado, unetaken et hasheni haomid kenegdo. we look to see which one is alone the truth, and we correct the one that disagrees with the truth. Note, he doesn't say we always take the text as being the most important, nor does he say we always take rabbinic tradition as being the most important. He said, we look at the conflict and we decide one of them is right. And then we play with the second one to get it to go along. So in an example that you don't have here, but I mentioned it before, when it says, va'avado le'olam, he will be his servant forever, there, even Ezra sees a conflict. The halacha says le'olam means until the Jubilee year. The word seems to mean forever. He says, well, olam has a lot of meanings in biblical Hebrew, and maybe it just means the longest time period that we really know, and the longest time period that we really know is the Jubilee. And so maybe it makes sense to say that le'olam means, he doesn't say maybe, he says, so it makes sense to say that le'olam, so there he kind of says the tradition trumps, and that we're netakein, we'll fix that word le'olam and get it to go along with tradition. But this time he's going to do the precise opposite. There are passages that our ancient rabbis treated as mnemonics, as purely an asmachta. We'll talk a little more about this word, asmachta. But they, of course, understood what the contextual meaning of Scripture is, for they were masters of all wisdom. We have to say that the rabbis, of course, they understood the Torah. They were smart people. I understand the Torah. I read the Torah. I understand what v'yarash ota means. Of course the rabbis knew that. How could anybody say that they didn't understand what those words mean? For example, when they interpreted the phrase v'yarash ota teaches that a husband inherits his wife's estate. Why did they do that? That is because they had an uncontested tradition passed on by the prophets that a man inherits his wife's estate. So they made this verse into an asmachta, a mnemonic. In the chicken the egg question, what came first, the rabbinic teaching or the connection to the verse? Ibn Ezra says here, the rabbinic teaching came first. The rabbis had a tradition. It went back. It's part of the Torah Shebe'al Peh, an uncontested tradition reaching back all through the years. And this tradition told them that when a married woman dies, then her husband inherits her estate. And then they artificially attached that tradition to this verse, even though they knew that it isn't what the words mean. And why did they do that? As a kind of mnemonic device. Because now that you've heard this class that I'm leading, next time you're in shul, and you hear this section of the Torah read, and you hear those two words, v'yarash ota, you will say, oh, I know what that means, or I know what that teaches us. That teaches us that a man inherits his wife's estate. So it's to cause that causal connection in the Jewish listener's head when he or she is in shul on the appropriate week. And so you will remember that halacha when you hear those words, even though the halacha does not derive from those words. So there's no, in the history of where the halacha came from, there is no connection between the halacha and those words, and it was just later artificially attached to it. Because, of course, the verse says that the inheritance is given to the she'er. So he starts to point out problems. If you look at the verse, it says, "Unutatem et nachlato l'she'ero." You shall give the inheritance l'she'ero. Wait a second. Somebody said she'er means wife. Does this mean that we give the inheritance to the wife? Well, some of us might wish that that were the case, but that isn't what the rabbinic literature says. And so the rabbis must have known when they said that she'er means wife. And they can read Hebrew, and it says, give his inheritance, l'she'ero, and then they said a woman doesn't inherit from her husband. So they must have known that it just doesn't work to offer an interpretation like this. Ech nahafoch hadavar, how can we reverse it when it says l'she'ero? And what about the phrase at the beginning of the verse, if his father had no brothers? The verse never told us what to do if he has no uncles, as we have interpreted the verse to be about husbands and wives. So what do you do when a man doesn't have uncles? So we thought that the rest of the verse means, well, look for the closest relative and give it to the closest relative. But you just said that that isn't what the verse means. The verse means give a woman's estate to her husband. So they never finished the thought at the beginning of the verse. And furthermore, does a man inherit his wife's estate only if he has no uncles? The verse begins and says, if a man has no sons, no daughters, no brothers, and no uncles, then he inherits his wife's estate. You can't read a text that way, says Ibn Ezra. It's a distortion of the text. And so what we have to say is that the rabbis were not reading a text. This has nothing to do with biblical interpretation. The authority of this, Ibn Ezra is a religious Jew who believes in Jewish law, and he says the authority of this is tradition. Tradition taught us. There's a Masorah, a tradition that goes back, Torah l'Moshe miSinai. An oral Torah teaches us that a man inherits his wife's estate. And then it was attached to the verse artificially. And finally, his strongest point, furthermore, following the pshat, a wife is not referred to as she'er. We saw that even Rashi said she'er can't mean wife. And Ibn Ezra has, I think, a clinching proof of this, and that's the verse, Ish ish el kol she'er besaro lo tikrevu legalot erva. If she'er means wife, we are all in very big trouble. Then the verse means that no man should approach his she'er sexually. And so Ibn Ezra says that no one would say that that is the meaning of the verse. So how in the world? So Rashi may, when Rashi admitted, you know, afagav de she'ero dekra lavishto he, even though she'er doesn't really mean wife in the Bible, it might be because Rashi was thinking about this verse also, but Ibn Ezra, who's a little bit of a rascal, he says it quite clearly. You can't say that she'er means wife unless you say that. Well, okay, I already said it. Don't have to say it again. So is she'er besaro different from
someone related blood, perhaps, rather than non?
Uh-huh. Okay. Jerry is suggesting a kind of defense that against Ibn Ezra's accusation. That's very nice to say that maybe the rabbis did this only for she'er besaro, which might not be the same as she'ero. Okay, I hear that that possibility that she'er besaro means a blood relative. So where did these halachot come from that seem to have no connection to the biblical text? Just to review again, Rashi's explanation was they came from superfluous words in the text, and Ibn Ezra's explanation, they came from traditions that go back to Mount Sinai that were passed along orally. And now, this all fits in with a theory of Ibn Ezra's. It's so shocking to hear to read Ibn Ezra's theory of meaning, especially when you remember that Ibn Ezra was a poet. And poets generally understand, I'm not a poet, and I'm not even the best reader of poetry around, but one thing that I know about poetry is that it's very often possible to read a line of a poem in more than one way. And that makes it into a, they tell me, people who know poetry better than I do, that makes it into a better poem sometimes when there are multiple levels of meaning. And despite the fact that Ibn Ezra was a poet, and a pretty good poet, they say, that isn't his understanding of meaning. In his grammar book, Yesod Dikduk, on top of page 3 here, Ibn Ezra has this little passage here making fun of people who have ideas about biblical interpretation that he doesn't like. He's talking about somebody who says, this verse has 10 different meanings. He's so proud of himself. that he's figured out 10 ways of explaining this verse. I think we've all been at Divrei Torah like that, where somebody lists all the possible meanings, and Ibn Ezra is making fun of somebody who does something like this. And when people hear about this, his reputation as an exegete, as a commentator, rises. But the opposite is true, for when he offers 10 explanations for the verse, he has no idea which one is the true explanation. When you give 10 explanations, that means you don't know. We all know that when you give too many answers, that's because you don't have any. It might be, it's a dray. In fact, the correct explanation might not even be included. You know, if we got 10, who says that you've got the right one? And then he says, ki kol mechaber sefer navi haya o chacham, Ta'am echad lidvarav. For there is only one correct explanation. The word ta'am in Ibn Ezra's Hebrew often means explanation and not reason. There is only one correct explanation for the words of any author, whether he be a prophet or a sage. It's an amazing theory of textual interpretation. You don't like it, Jerry, of course. You know, I know Jerry well enough to know that Jerry does not like the claim that a text has one level of interpretation. What's this poet doing telling me that every text only has one level of interpretation, one correct level of interpretation? Right.
Hitting the rock, all the stuff, and then you've got layers and levels and atomic analysis, nuclear analysis.
Right. Right, how could it, yes, okay. So maybe Ibn Ezra's theory will not be our favorite of the three theories that we're looking at today. We have heard eloquent criticism from Jerry on the subject. Okay, I'm ready to go on to the third theory, unless somebody wants to stop me. Yes, Happy, please. This text, I went to a lecture by Professor Uriel Simon, who's one of my favorite Bible scholars and perhaps the world expert on Ibn Ezra, and he taught me about this text, and he was the one who said that he just couldn't figure out what a poet was doing writing a text like this. I'm going to ask Uri next time I see him what he thinks of your theory there, that maybe he sees prose and poetry as being very different from each other.
Mm-hmm. He rejects that completely and even makes fun of it. And yet, you would check his poetry and see how he uses my poetry.
Right. That's a very nice possibility that he makes an exception for poetry. But I think that most of us, not just Jerry and me, but I think probably a lot of people here in the room think that prose also can be multivalent, that it isn't only poetry that can be multivalent, that can have more than one meaning at the same time. Okay, now going to move on to category number three of how to deal with the tension between what the Bible says and what halakha does with it. Jack, you want to read the text? Six.
Sure.
Thank you. A man opens a pit or digs a pit and doesn't cover the pit, and an ox or an ass falls into it. It's an interesting, halachic category. The rabbis always interpreted that this pit is in public property, and so I don't own this public property, but I made a nuisance on public property. And it certainly makes sense that when you make a nuisance on public property, you are responsible for this, even though you don't own the public property. Yes? Very good. Rabbi Grafstein is quoting the famous line from the Talmud Bavli that says, there are various things that a person does not own, but the Torah made it as if they own it. And one of them is when you make a boar on public property. And we all understand here there's no problem figuring out the motivation of the legislator for something like this. So an animal falls in there. It's an assumption in that society that animals will be walking through the street, will be walking through public property. They have to get from one place to another, just the way human beings walk through public places. So the animals have the right to walk through public places. The animal falls into the pit. So what do? The owner makes the person who dug the pit. The owner of the pit. That's actually the language that the Gemara picked up on that Rabbi Grafstein alluded to. The owner of the pit. What does it mean to own the pit? How can you own something in public property? And so that's an excellent example of good close textual reading by the Talmud, noticing that it doesn't say the person who dug the pit, but the owner of the pit. So it's as if he now owns this pit. Yes? Yes, very good. I'm not going to explain that, but only because of time, but I will agree with you. So the owner of the pit makes restitution. With money, he must pay the owner, although it's possible that kesef doesn't mean money. It might mean silver. It's debatable whether kesef actually could mean money in a biblical passage. V'hamit yiyeh lo, but the dead animal shall be his. Now, is that phrase ambiguous, or is that phrase not ambiguous? V'hamit yiyeh lo. Shall we take a vote on the subject? Anybody want to express an opinion on that subject? Is that phrase ambiguous?
There's nothing in the Bible that's ambiguous.
Even Ezra just told us. Are there two possibilities of interpretation that we ought to be considering now before we move on to deciding? Yes, David. Okay, so I agree with David that there's a theoretical ambiguity here because there are two nouns, there are two people. There's the person who dug the pit, and there's the person who owns the animal, and there's a reference to his, to a third person singular pronoun. It's theoretically ambiguous. Anybody want to say anything beyond the theoretical ambiguity? Yes, Milton. The debt is his responsibility? The death. I've never seen that. I don't want to rule something out, Milton, just because I've never seen it, but I've never seen anybody suggesting that. It's generally understood that hamet means the carcass. So if you had to guess which one is the correct interpretation of the text, what would you guess?
Well, aren't there other examples in Mishpatim of this concept of, you pay, but you get the carcass? Or is there other examples?
Right. So every modern commentator who has written on the Bible and every pshat-oriented commentator who has written on the Bible in medieval times always understood this text as meaning. So I dug this pit. Jerry's animal was innocently walking along, fell into the pit. So I pay Jerry the cost of an animal, and I get the carcass, and I can go and sell the carcass. It seems like that's the only reasonable way of reading the text here, despite the theoretical, I agree, David, there's a theoretical syntactical ambiguity, but it seems like the way Jerry described it is the reasonable way of understanding this text. However, the Babylonian Talmud says the precise opposite. And that's text number 7. Pardon me?
Because Vadma ELO could be superfluous, because of course if you pay for it,
yes, precisely. Because it's, that's right.
So
yes. Very good. And the reason is because of the superfluity. Yes, I had an expert in reading Midrash and understanding Midrash. So from the standard Rashi kind of point of view, we totally understand why the Talmud came to the opposite. So I'll just read through this Aramaic here quickly, and then for those of you who appreciate Aramaic. If it just wanted to tell me that I have to pay Jerry the full cost of the animal, then it should have just said, Marty has to pay Jerry the full cost of the animal. And then, of course, I would know then that I'd get to keep the carcass. So it certainly wouldn't make sense that Jerry would get the carcass and he would also get the full cost of the animal. And so, as Anna put it, that means we have superfluous words here. So why did the Torah write, the dead animal shall be his? From this we learn that the dead animal goes to the person who suffered the damages. Shma mina lanizak. That Jerry gets the carcass, that's what it means there. And when it says that I pay Jerry, it means that I pay Jerry an amount to make him whole, because he had an animal that was worth $1,000, and now he has a carcass that's worth $50, and so I have to make him whole, giving him the $950 that he is out. And he might prefer, actually, in the Talmudic discussion, it might be made clear that Jerry would probably prefer just to have the $1,000 instead of having to deal with the carcass. But I am allowed to say, Jerry, you take the carcass, and I will make you whole beyond the carcass. And Jerry can't say, no, I don't want to deal with this. So that's how that's what the Talmud does with it. So it seems like the Talmud has come up with an interpretation that is not the standard intuitive reading of the text.
Okay.
Right, yes. Rabbi Grafstein is correct that there are many complications of this law, and the part that we read didn't even talk at all about what happens when a human being falls into the pit. So we have to go on, because we don't have too much time.
Right,
very good. Right. So the third theory on the subject, if we go to page 4 now, is the theory of a commentator, Shmuel David Luzzatto Shadal, lived in Italy from 1800 to 1865. He taught at the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Padua most of his life, and he was a brilliant man, and he wrote a brilliant commentary on the Bible. So here's what he wrote about this verse. The dead animal shall be his, in other words, shall be the property of the one responsible for the damage, since he had made recompense for the entire value of the animal. So he understands that the pshat is, the way we explained it the first time, that I give Jerry the $1,000 to make him, which is what his animal used to be worth, and I walk off with the carcass. That's what the text meant. And that Rashbam, some of you will know that that's my favorite Bible commentator, that, you know, in the 12th century, Rashbam said that's obviously what the text meant. Rashbam was a Talmudist who did his Bible study kind of on the side, and despite the fact that he was a Talmudist, he was often willing to interpret. He did not accept that principle of Ibn Ezra, that there's only one interpretation for every passage. He says, you want to know what the pshat is? The pshat is the opposite of what the rabbis said here. And he knows, it's not because he didn't know the Talmudic passage, it's just because he still respects his own ability to read a text. So what do we do with this? So Shadal, here's Shadal's theories. But the rabbis decided to be more lenient than the Torah was to the one who cut, that's my adding those words, than the Torah was, but that's obviously what it means. You know, the Torah wanted me to give Jerry $1,000. The rabbis decided to give me a break, and they told me that I only have to come up with $950, and I can give Jerry the carcass for the last $50. The rabbis decided to be more lenient to the one who caused the damage. They said that he does not have to make recompense specifically with money. As the verse says, with money he must pay the owner, but he can repay with any item, including a carcass. I could give you a carcass. I can give you postage stamps if I want, and I could give you a carcass as a way of giving you the $1,000. He can leave him the carcass as partial payment and then give him a further monetary payment to make up for the difference between the worth of the live animal and a carcass. Shadal does this numerous times in his Bible commentary when he finds a tension between what the verse means and what the rabbis said. He essentially says that the rabbis were legislators and not interpreters of the biblical text. And text number 9, I'll just do it quickly and give a fast introduction to it. There's a concept of various different kinds of tithes that have to be given. There's the Israelite farmer has to give Ma'aser Rishon every year. And then in a 7-year cycle, in years numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5, the Israelite farmer is supposed to give a second tithe called Ma'aser Sheni, which the farmer takes to Jerusalem and eats this food in Jerusalem. He's allowed to keep it, but he's supposed to share his largesse with the poor and the needy who are in Jerusalem who have come up for the... So when people come for the pilgrimage festivals for the Regalim in Jerusalem, even if they don't have much money, there'll be all these people who are there with their Ma'aser Sheni, and they'll be distributing it because they'll have too much food to eat themselves in Jerusalem. When you go up, and you know, it sometimes feels on Pesach that we've eaten 1/10 of all of our produce for the year on Pesach, but it really is not the case that we're actually capable in a short holiday like that of eating 10% of the 10% of the stuff. But in years number 3 and 6 of the cycle, instead of Ma'aser Sheni, there's a tithe that goes directly to the poor. And through complicated derashot, complicated explanations of biblical texts, the rabbis found hints in the text that in years 1, 2, 4, and 5, we give Ma'aser Sheni, and in years 3 and 6, we give Ma'aser Ani. Shadal looked at the verses and looked at the laws, and he just scratched his head, and he said, how did they get from these verses to these laws? So he comes up with a theory, how they got there, and it has nothing to do with interpreting texts. He writes, apparently after the number of cheaters who would deny the poor their share increased and they would say to the poor, we have nothing left to give you from the Maaser Sheni that we took to Jerusalem. They saw that it wasn't working all the time. That people would show up in Jerusalem and the poor would come expecting to be getting some of the Maaser Sheni from these wealthy farmers who had allegedly brought 10% of their produce to Jerusalem for consuming during these holidays in order to be able to share it with the less wealthy people in society on these holidays. So the rabbis legislated that in the third year there would be no Maaser Sheni, but the tithe that would be separated would go entirely to the poor. They kind of taxed the rich people in society. They took away the money from the rich to give it to the poor, various politicians discuss whether that is something good to do or bad to do. Shatal said that's what the rabbis did. They changed the laws of Maaser because they saw that the poor were getting cheated, and they figured that at least in years 3 and 6, the poor would not get cheated. Finally, Shadal, in the last page here of the handout, gives a kind of summary of his approach on this subject. So as I said, there are many, many cases where Shadal says that the gap between what the rabbis said and what the Bible said is a result of the rabbis being legislators. So he writes here, text number 10, after many years of wondering, I'm not even going to explain what this verse is about because it doesn't matter, but anyways, on this verse here that Shadal's commenting on here, Rashbam wrote, Chachamim akruhu mipshuto. The rabbis took this verse and totally uprooted the simple meaning of the text. After many years of wondering why the rabbis, as Rashbam put it, uprooted this verse from its pshat, today on Purim, 1847, I understand why. That's what he was doing on Purim. Poor guy sitting there thinking, what could be the solution to the tension between the meaning of the text and the Midrashim? He said, today, finally I figured it out on Purim. Dr. Nussbaum is suggesting that perhaps a little inebriation might have helped him finally figure out the truth on the subject. Pardon me? Yes, when liquor comes in, then the secret meanings come out. Similarly, now I understand why. And you notice the Hebrew he writes there. He writes, Zachiti lavin mara'u al kacha. Mara'u al kacha is a quotation from Megillat Esther. He's playing with the language and standard rabbinic ways. V'chein b'chol makom. Similarly, this is the theory. Whenever you find not just one rabbi, but the rabbis as a whole, without disputes, straying from the pshat of the verse, it is not because they made an exegetical error. It's not because they didn't know how to understand a biblical verse. Rather, it was a new regulation they enacted to respond to the needs of the generation, that the rabbis were legislators. Umi chamohem reformator. Where can we find reformers like them? So he lived in the beginning of Reform Judaism. He was a staunch opponent of Reform Judaism. As I said, he taught in the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Padua all of his life. But he said, you can't find reformatorim like those rabbis of ours, that the Talmud is filled with rabbis who were reformators. However, their new regulations were based on deep wisdom, fear of God, and love of humanity. That's why they were reformatorim, because they loved human beings, they feared God, and they were deeply wise. They were not done, so this is his assessment of why he doesn't like the reformatorim of the 19th century. That the reformers that we have these days are doing reforms because it makes it simpler for them or it gains favor in the eyes of other people. Without saying something so negative about reform as Shadal is saying, everybody knows that one of the one of the motivations for reform was to make it easier for Jews to be accepted in the emancipation of the Jews. It was felt by many of the leaders of Reform Judaism would be easier if some of the laws separating Jews and non-Jews were relaxed, and then it would be easier to turn to the non-Jews and say, please emancipate the Jews, please give full rights to the Jews. Okay, so now just to sum up, these are the three theories that I have found over the years about how to deal with this problem. Rashi's theory, whenever there are superfluous words in the text, red flag, change the rules, stop using simple text reading rules. Ibn Ezra's theory that says we have our skills as text readers and we also have various traditions that have come down to us, and the traditions are the source of these laws, but not, they aren't connected to the text. And then Shatal one-ups Ibn Ezra and says, not a tradition, it's that the rabbis looked at what the generation needed, and the generation needed these laws, and they needed more leniencies, and they, for that reason, you shouldn't relate to this as interpretation, you should relate to it as legislation. Rabbi Kelman just gave the signal of 5 minutes. Any comments or questions? I actually finished, but I can take some questions. Okay. Yes, Rabbi Grafstein.
4 minutes now.
Okay. Yes. Okay, so Rabbi Grafstein is taking us into a new direction of who would be allowed to do this, which I isn't necessarily our topic right now, but I hear what you're saying. Yes, Anna.
For the Ibn Ezra approach, I'm assuming he uses for other examples as well, then, not just...
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
So are there examples of that exist, like that he brings from, you know, Mishnah, Tosefta, Midrashei Halakha, whatever, without the Psukim, and then later it seems like they get somewhat artificially added on, or are you just kind of assuming that we're going to go along with this?
No, he is speculatively reconstructing what must have happened. That when we see the rabbis say, here's what the words mean, then he says to himself, nobody could actually mean that. And so they must be saying, we had a tradition that this is the law, and so we went and attached this to the verse. But that it is not based on finding two texts and saying, here's the older text when that was just a tradition, and then it was attached. No, he's just speculatively reconstructed this. Yes, Sophia. Yes. So it's an amazing idea that Shaddal is saying that God, you know, Shaddal was a very observant man, and he believes in Torah, Moshe, Mi-Sinai, and this is what God wanted us to be doing, but that God empowered the rabbis that they could, according to the needs of their generation, overrule that and be more lenient and let the guy off the hook for what the Torah said. You can either like that or not like that, Sophia. But it's a daring idea. Yes, Jack. Last question, Jack. Yes, please.
That's right.
Fortunately,
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, we're seeing this way of accommodating to life.
Right. Very nice. Good summary. Thank you, Jack.
Okay. Thank you very much.